Hi everyone, we're going to get started with our next talk. So our next speaker is Sakivu Hutchinson. She is a feminist, atheist, author and novelist, and playwright. She's the founder of the Women's Leadership Project Black Feminist Mentoring Program in South LA's high schools, and author of the novel White Knights, Black Paradise, on Black Women, People's Temples, and the Jamestown Massacre in 2015, Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels, Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars, and the forthcoming novel, Rock and Roll Heretic, The Life and Times of Ori Tharp. In 2013, she was named Secular Woman of the Year, and she was awarded the Secular Student Alliance's 2016 Backbone Award. She's producing the play adaptation of White Knights Paradise this fall in LA. Her talk title is Black Feminism and Free Thought. Can we please give her a warm welcome?
Okay, good evening. So thanks to AHA and good evening, everyone. Happy Women's History Month. There's a powerful sequence in Aisha Simmons' 2006 documentary on rape and sexual assault in the African-American community that begins with an intercut sequence featuring Louis Farrakhan, the bigoted asshole who recently slammed Jews as satanic, and an African-American minister rallying their flock in the pulpit against African-American rape victim Desiree Washington. Some of you may recall that Desiree Washington was a young African-American woman who accused Mike Tyson, the boxer, of raping her in his hotel room in 1991. And so in this particular sequence, these good men of God are holding forth and basically demolishing the character of Desiree Washington, claiming that the allegations that she brought against Iron Mike were false, were frivolous. And in one sequence, Farrakhan even goes so far as to exhort black women and say, women, you know full well the evil that you do. These good men of God, evidently not giving a damn, it's been only recently that black women have been considered to be possible rape victims in the eyes of the law. Whereas white women have always been, in the words of Elaine Brown, former Black Panther Party minister, Miss Ann. Black women have never been considered to be Miss Anne. That is, the female ideal of beauty, desirability, humanity, morality, and civilization. And so it's this critical distinction that has always informed the divide between white feminism and black feminism, particularly in this era in which the Me Too movement has been appropriated by elite white women from an African-American woman named Tarana Burke, who spearheaded the movement and the term Me Too decades ago, in this era where we have a highly activist, conservative, reactionary, white, female body politic that has co-signed the imperialist, racist, white supremacist, and homophobic tyranny of Donald Trump, elected him, and basically left this as their most enduring legacy. And so it's these regimes of respectability and erasure that continue to inform black women's relationship to religion on the one hand and non-belief on the other hand, where African-American women have historically been branded as morally other, as debased, as unrapable Jezebels. And so in 2016, I wrote this piece entitled 10 Fierce Atheists and Nary a Horseman to be Found, in this article that spotlighted politically progressive African-American women atheists from all walks of life. A gallery of fabulous women that include Liz Ross from Black Skeptics LA, Ayanna Wilford from Secular Sisters, Deanna Adams, Jimmy LaFouley, Laura James, Deanne Burkholder, Bria Crutchfield from Black Nonbelievers, Debbie Goddard, who is in the audience, and shout out to my comrade from CFI, Mandisa Thomas, the founder of Black Nonbelievers, and Sharon Paget. And these are all, again, prominent activists, organizers, and leaders within the free thought, atheist, and humanist movement that some of you may not be aware of because of the intense preoccupation on the primacy of four horsemen. And so I began the article by citing a sequence that occurs in Lorraine Hansberry's 1950s play, A Raisin in the Sun, Hansberry also being a prominent freethinker. And it features the characters Beneath the Younger, an Afrocentric atheist, and her mother, Lena Younger, a devout Christian. And so in this scene, Beneatha is challenging the verities of organized religion and Christian idolatry. And she says to her mother, "Mama, it's all a matter of ideas, and God is just one idea I don't accept. I get so tired of him getting credit for all the things the human race achieves through its own stubborn effort." So Lena responds by slapping Beneatha and forcing her to repeat, "In my mother's house, there is still God." And so this violent rebuke of Beneatha by Lena is really a caveat to all of the uppity black women atheists who are more or less rendered invisible within mainstream African-American cultural representations that are still very much steeped in Christian dogma and Christian faith. Because in many regards, to be a black woman non-believer, to be a black woman free thinker, is to be a race traitor. And this is exemplified by the prevalence of Jesus idolatry, for example, in black pop culture, where whenever you have a black celebrity, a politician, an actor, a rapper, a musician, bound up on stage and accept an award, invariably, Jesus, God, Father, Father God is invoked, lest people risk having their race credentials revoked. It's reflected in the prevalence of demonizing caricatures of black women in black films and TV, particularly in the entire body of work of Tyler Perry, where every other character is a Bible-thumping, scripture-spewing, have-a-blessed-day-invoking cartoon. It's also exemplified in irreverent portrayals like the recent black female bonding blockbuster Girls Trip, where you have the lead protagonist bonding in an elite hotel room through a come-to-Jesus prayer circle. And it's also exemplified by the relative dearth of scholarship, and not just critical, nonfiction-oriented scholarship, but also scholarship that examines cultural production, the arts, literature, from a black feminist secular perspective, excluding my work, and excluding the great work of my colleague Candace Gorman, who's also in the audience. Shout out to her and her book, Ebony Exodus. I highly recommend that you seek that book out. But the issue is that there is this vacuum that needs to be challenged and addressed when we talk about canonical literature on secularism in the United States. And so how then do black women go beyond belief in their life's work as educators, as activists, as scholars, as intellectuals, as workers in the day-to-day? How do they connect a humanistic vision with intersectionality, with feminism, with queerness, with critiques of white supremacy? So to put this into some context, according to the Pew Research Survey, 87% of African Americans are religiously identified, making African Americans among the most religious groups in the United States, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, a survey that was done a few years ago. 87% of African American women look to their faith in times of turmoil, look to faith to pull them through. If we look at some of the stats and demographics on LGBTQ African Americans, black, gay, and bisexual Americans are not only more religious than their white counterparts, but also quite possibly more religious than Americans as a whole. If we're talking about African American women, cis, queer, straight, trans, a majority go to church on a regular basis, read the Bible on a regular basis, and tied a significant portion of their incomes to supporting churches and faith-based institutions, despite having the least wealth among any population in the United States, a whopping penny to the dollar of white families. And so, of course, in Black culture. The church has always been a deeply public cultural affair, a deeply public heterosexist cultural affair, born of centuries of strife, struggle, and segregation. And it's precisely because of this intersection of white supremacy, socioeconomic disenfranchisement, and segregation that churches became centers of black political life, of black organizing, of solidarity, of civil rights movement resistance. And it's precisely because, in many regards, of the intractability of institutional discrimination in jobs, in housing, in education, that churches, in many regards, remain vital to particularly working class and lower middle class African American communities. African American women have always played a key role in black church leadership, in black church membership, but have been erased, have been dehumanized and debased by a black patriarchal leadership that has always sought unlimited power, domination, and control over black women's self-determination, over their agency, over their role in the family, over their sexuality. And it's a leadership that has done so in heterosexist and heteronormative ways that has disenfranchised LGBTQ and queer African Americans both within the pulpit and outside the pulpit, leading to this normalization of cultures of sexual abuse and predation. And so, like many African Americans in the so-called Christian nation, there is this belief that Christianity is synonymous with morality, and vice versa. Not a surprise. And so this was one of the reasons why in 2011 I wrote Moral Combat, not only to unpack traditions of black radical humanism from a historical perspective, but to really connect this legacy and connect this trajectory to contemporary black, atheist, secular, and free thought organizing, and to look at the context from whence it came in terms of contemporary dynamics in disenfranchised, impoverished, and middle-class African-American communities. And to also highlight the ways in which atheists and secularists of color, who were progressive, who are social justice-oriented, have been demonized within a Eurocentric, white-dominated, atheist, humanist context. It's important to understand that throughout American history, towering figures of African-American political activism have espoused secular humanism in their life's work. Folk like James Baldwin and A. Philip Randolph and Zora Neale Hurston and Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois, Richard Wright, Hubert Henry Harrison, and Nella Larsen. Nella Larsen is significant because she is the first African-American woman to feature an explicitly skeptic black female protagonist in her 1928 novel, Quicksand. And this protagonist, Helga Crane, is unabashed in her criticism of God belief and Christian idolatry. Very frontal in unpacking the way in which Christian idolatry undermines black African-American working-class folk, undermines the radical impulse within African-American communities. Zora Neale Hurston is also significant because in her 1942 essay, Religion, she talks about her blossoming as a freethinker and as a skeptic, coming from a deeply religious background where she was the daughter of a pastor, and says that God belief and groupthink really offended her sense of intellectual independence. She says that, "I was asked if I loved God, and I always said yes, because that was the thing I was supposed to say." And so even blossoming as a freethinker and as a skeptic, Zora Neale Hurston knew full well the power and the seduction of faith for a people who to this day find their humanity violently and terroristically contested, where African American women in the so-called exceptionalist democracy continue to have the least equitable access to housing, to living wage jobs, to reproductive health care. And so, if we're talking about the legacy and the trajectory of African-American secularism. Again, it's important to understand that it has always been steeped in Black liberation struggle. That it's always been steeped in a social justice ethos that has been oriented towards looking at the ways in which white supremacy and Jim Crow and imperialism and capitalism inform Black lives in the here and now. One of the most towering representations of this worldview was A. Philip Randolph. Randolph, of course, one of the most important labor organizers and human rights activists in the United States, the founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union for railroad workers of African descent, and the founder of the March on Washington movement, which was a precursor to the 1963 March on Washington, the founder of the Socialist Messenger publication that was the font of radical organizing in the 1930s and 40s. And so Randolph excoriated what he dubbed to be Orthodox Christianity in his journal, The Messenger, and really criticized the way in which, quote-unquote, Orthodox Christianity undermines the African-American impulse to organize against capitalism, to organize against social injustice. And so these are some of the critical distinctions between an atheist, secular, and free thought framework that is Eurocentric, that is primarily focused on church-state separation and science, espoused by white male academic elites like Dawkins, Harris, and company, and an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, radical and intersectional atheist and secular framework that's espoused by progressive and radical African-American folk and other folk of color that is engaged, for example, in the lived experiences and the struggles of contemporary Black neighborhoods increasingly under siege by gentrification, by unaffordable housing prices, by unaffordable rental prices, by whites who are encroaching upon historically African-American and Latinx neighborhoods because they have discovered the ghetto and have been priced out of their communities, and are hence fueling a deepening epidemic of homelessness where African-Americans have been intensely impacted. In L.A. County, for example, African-Americans comprise 50% of the homeless population. And so Black women secularists are really concerned with examining the gap between the four S's that are traditionally provided by the best of organized religion, that is, social services, social welfare, solidarity, and social history, and forging a humanistic vision of community, especially in light of these deepening wealth divides between African Americans and whites, where whites now have over 22 times the wealth of African Americans, in light of skyrocketing rates of mass incarceration, in light of deepening hyper-segregation in K-12 schools as a result of neoliberal policies and charterization and undermining of teachers' unions, and in light of not just a deepening school-to-prison pipeline, but a deepening sexual abuse-to-prison pipeline that disproportionately criminalizes, convicts, and locks up African-American girls in greater and greater numbers for the crime of being domestic sex trafficking victims, for the crime of being child rape victims. African-American girls have some of the highest rates of domestic sex trafficking, and has a lot to do with this nexus of mass incarceration and overrepresentation in foster care and push out and oversuspension and overexpulsion in K-12 schools. And so it's this constellation of mass incarceration of youth and adults, of over-suspension, over-expulsion, and push-out of African-American children at younger and younger ages, as young as preschool, that is really fueling the gravest public health crisis against African-American communities contemporarily. And so recently, Georgetown University did a study that examined, quote-unquote, adultification amongst African-American girls. and concluded that African-American girls, to use their term, were more adultified than African-American boys. And what this signifies is that African-American girls are viewed as more sexually aggressive and mature beyond their chronological age. And it implies that Black girls are not perceived to be innocent, are not afforded with the protections that are typically afforded children, and that this has fueled the epidemic of harsher discipline that's imposed upon Black girls, where African-American girls have the highest suspension rates next to African-American boys in K-12 schools. And so the Georgetown study merely confirms what Black women and girls have known and experienced for generations, namely that the presumption of innocence and vulnerability, again, afforded to white girls since infancy, extracts a considerable material, social, and psychological toll on African-American girls and women and Black communities. Case in point, going back to the hashtag MeToo movement and the way in which it's been hijacked by white elites, white women elites in corporate America and in the entertainment industry. Because every time we'll turn on mainstream TV, we do not see Black faces. We do not hear Black voices in this brave new era unpacking the normalization of sexual violence and rape culture. And this despite the fact that African-American girls have some of the highest rates of sexual harassment and sexual abuse victimization alongside multiracial and indigenous girls. And so this image here is from Dorsey High School, where my Women's Leadership Project Feminist and Humanist of Color mentoring program is located in South LA, one of the schools. And this is a poster that the young women put together as part of a sexual harassment prevention and sexual violence prevention campaign that we launched, talking about some of the demographics and stats vis-a-vis Black girls and Black women. And we tried to get an editorial in the LA Times called Me Too in Our Schools, looking at Black girls in the Los Angeles Unified School District. The editorial was rejected because the LA Times was singularly focused on highlighting and privileging the voices of elite white women in the entertainment industry. And so if we're talking about this question of the high levels of religiosity among African-American women, it's really important to look at the ways in which Black female morality have historically been defined. Christianity has historically been a gender-defining mechanism for African-Americans. And these hierarchies of masculinity and femininity typically pivot on hierarchies of race. So in her book, Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination, Toni Morrison talks about how democracy in the so-called New World was really predicated on the creation of the sovereign, civilized, citizen, rational white male, coupled with the idealized, innocent, chaste white woman, in turn predicated on the creation of the dark, hypersexual, savage, Black other. And so the dark, hypersexual, savage, Black other was signified on the one hand by the Black woman as Jezebel Greer, Unbreakable, and on the other by African-American men as uber rapists. And this figure of the hypersexual, unbreakable Black Jezebel stood in stark contrast to that of the Black man, asexual, caregiving to the end, constantly serving the needs of the white plantation master and his family, over and above her needs, which of course she didn't have under the regime of slavery, her family and her community. And so this demonization of Black womanhood was not only a caricature, but it was also an indictment of quote-unquote bad Black motherhood. And this indictment and narrative was most egregiously exemplified in the 1965 Moynihan Report that some older folk in the audience may be familiar with. The Moynihan Report was commissioned by the LBJ administration, and it was authored by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who went on to become a prominent Democratic senator. And it essentially vilified the so-called black matriarchy and said that the black matriarchy was the font of all black inner-city cultural dysfunction. So all the drugs, all the crime, all the violence, all the poverty, all the so-called illegitimacy was due to this topsy-turvy family structure that existed in inner-city black communities that was so anomalous vis-a-vis traditional, normative, white patriarchal family structures. And so the Moynihan Report continues to cast a long shadow over the portrayal of black female morality and linking it to the downward spiral and the so-called pathology of inner-city black families. For example, when the GOP demonized Barack Obama as the food stamp president, and when it customarily demonizes abortion and birth control as the province of sex-crazed sluts, black women's bodies are its not-so-silent, not-so-secret currency. And even though there has been this terroristic religious right backlash against women's rights, against abortion rights, against LGBTQ and undocumented immigrant rights, against humanity, in other words, even though we see wave upon wave of Planned Parent clinic closures engineered by an activist religious right, closures that are occurring in the Midwest, in the Deep South, in states like Mississippi and Alabama and Texas, that disproportionately impact African-American, Latinx, and indigenous women, disproportionately undermine and subvert the socioeconomic sustainability of communities of color. Even though we see this white religious right devastation wreaking havoc across the nation, there are not droves and droves of women of color who are leaving organized religion, proclaiming their secular identities, and renouncing God. And why? Because of the insidiousness of these taboos on the morality of black women and the morality of women of color. Because there is a litmus test to being a morally upright, respectable woman of color. It is that you have to be a woman of faith. You have to be a woman of spirituality. And so, going back to an earlier point I made, to compound matters, most of this literature on secularism and gender does not adequately represent the experiences of women of color navigating sexism, racism, sexual violence, transphobia, economic injustice in highly segregated, hyper-religious communities. And so the relative dearth of secular humanist and free thought traditions among women of color cannot be separated from this context, again, of segregation, white supremacy, and gender politics. The majority of historical secular women's literature actively celebrates the contributions of 19th century first wave white women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and the problem with these appraisals is that they conveniently erase the ways in which Stanton and her colleagues, most prominently Susan B. Anthony, utilized racist, xenophobic, nativist, and nationalist propaganda in their opposition, for example, to the 15th Amendment, which gave African-American men the right to vote in 1870. These women actively positioned themselves atop the hierarchy of Western civilization, next to white men, as beacons of civilization and rationality against the unwashed, hoi polloi men of color and non-Anglo men, in order to argue that we as white women should be given the vote over the unwashed. And so in her great book, highly recommended, called White Women's Rights, the historian Louise Michelle Newman notes that the feelings of racial superiority that Anglo-Protestants nurtured concerning their own ancestry, heredity, and evolutionary history led them to insist that they share the white man's inherited capacity for self-government. Indeed, it is not surprising that white female activists had a heightened racial consciousness of themselves as civilized women, contributing to and reinforcing dominant religious, scientific, and cultural ideologies that attribute to them unique moral and political roles on the basis of this identity. Blending religious conviction with science, i.e. social evolutionary theories, and political ideology, i.e. progressivism, white proponents of women's rights helped create new roles for themselves that explicitly maintained the racial hierarchies that were based on the presumption that Anglo-American Protestants were culturally as well as biologically superior to other peoples. And so in essence, black women did not have the luxury nor the privilege to be free thinkers in this brave new world of American individualism and enterprise, because their bodies were the raw material for American capitalism. Their reproductive and productive labor was the ground upon which American manifest destiny was forged. And so in many regards, I see a direct line, a through line, between the white supremacy of first wave 19th century feminists and the hashtag solidarities for white women privilege articulated by 21st century fourth wave feminists, or whatever wave we're on now. Some of you may have gone to the Women's March in major urban areas. WLP went to the Women's March, and we saw primarily a sea of white women. And so it was for these reasons that I founded WLP, a black feminist and feminist of color, again, civic engagement and mentoring program over a decade ago, after being frustrated by the absence of explicitly anti-racist feminist programs in the LAUSD, which is the second largest school district in the nation and has predominantly African-American, Latinx, and Asian students. And this was during a period in which there was a lot of tension between African-American and Latinx communities, where you had greater numbers of Latinx folk moving into traditionally, historically African-American communities, jockeying for power. The fierce youth in my WLP project define what culturally relevant humanism looks like in an age of educational apartheid, in an age where many of them are going to be the first in their families to go to college, in K-12 context where that is an anomaly. The majority go to college and come back to high school to mentor their peers. The core curriculum is humanist, focusing in part on the nexus between organized religion and gender hierarchy. And we train students to understand how heterosexist gender roles shape racist, sexist cultural expectations for women of color. They learn how to read, quote unquote, critically, and interrogate the media, interrogate public policy and sexism in their local communities. They develop a critical consciousness about how misogynist violence is normalized in their everyday lives. And students spearhead school community advocacy projects like our Step Forward Sexual Harassment Prevention Campaign, which was begun in 2015. And I'm particularly proud of them today because one of our cohorts at King Drew Medical Magnet High School, a science magnet, predominantly African-American Latino, located near Compton, has one of the highest four-year college-going rates in the LAUSD for black and brown students. These students have worked furiously over the past month to do a presentation that focuses on empowering LGBTQ and queer youth at their school campus. While we have a cohort today that went to a countywide leadership conference to talk about the campaign that we launched against rape culture in South LA schools, in Misogynoir, specifically looking at the lens of the sexist and misogynistic sexual violence against black women. And so we also support the citywide campaign against random searches in the LAUSD, which are not really random. They actually target African-American students disproportionately, fueling the school-to-prison pipeline. We support the coalition to dismantle the police state within LAUSD, where, again, you have the second largest school district in the nation that is conferring over $64 million to police. We're supporting the coalition that has developed to make a Black Lives Matter curriculum mandatory in the LAUSD, as well as transformative justice, which pushes back against oversuspension and overexpulsion. And so when we're talking about what humanist issues are, when students in predominantly white schools have unlimited access to college preparation resources, to counselors, to after-school programs, that is a humanist issue. That is a human rights issue. When my black male students from my Young Male Scholars program and their allies to the Women's Leadership Project tell me that they will consider themselves lucky to live to the age of 18, that is a humanist issue. That is a free thought issue. When we have an incarcerated adult population in California, which has the largest incarcerated population in the nation, the largest justice population in the nation, when we have an adult incarcerated population where the majority of them have come from foster care, and where 40% of foster care young people are African American, that is a humanist issue. Which brings me to Niani Duran, one of my ninth graders back in 2006. She's a former foster care student. She's the first in her family to go to college, got a full ride to Syracuse University, graduated with honors, is now enrolled, I'm proud to say, at UCLA Medical School and the Geffen Medical School. And so I featured her in this article that I wrote for the Humanist magazine called To Be Young, Secular, and Black. And so she had this to say about transitioning to agnosticism. I began to question the authenticity of religion in 2012, the year I started my undergrad program at Syracuse. As an elective, I registered for a women's and gender studies course, which exposed me to the reality of patriarchy. With this newfound knowledge, I was able to recognize patriarchal values throughout our society, including in its most widely distributed, quote-unquote, nonfiction book, the Bible. I found such patriarchal notions within a so-called holy text to be extremely hypocritical, and eventually found myself straying away from organized religion, specifically Christianity. After critical analysis, I've come to view organized religion as a source of revenue and as a system that perpetuates patriarchy by forbidding autonomy, especially for women. While I no longer identify as a Christian, I still have curiosity with regards to the existence / non-existence of a higher power, but I've come to accept that I will never know definitively and thus identify as an agnostic. And so these young people are part of Black Skeptics Los Angeles' First in the Family Humanist Scholarship Program, which Niani was also a part of. We have been going for about 5 years and have enjoyed the support of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, in addition to marvelous community sponsors like Frank Anderson and Debbie Barnes, who are sitting out in the audience, and Debbie Goddard, and individuals across the nation who espouse secularism, free thought, and atheism. It is a scholarship program that is primarily for secular young people of color in addition to undocumented LGBTQ, foster care, and homeless young people. And in closing, if black women are going to be self-determined as settlers, pursuing progressive humanist change, it must be on our own terms, in terms that don't replicate the hierarchies, the tyrannies, and the blind spots of organized religion and patriarchy. Because as black lesbian poet Audre Lorde said, to the Trumps and to the Moynihans and to the Farrakhans of the world, if I didn't define myself for myself, I'd be crushed into other people's fantasies of me and eaten alive. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this talk. I think there's a lot of well-meaning people that have no idea how to help with the problems you put forward. If you could bullet point a couple of things that we should be doing as a movement, as a group, as a society, to solve these issues of that you've brought up specifically, and specifically within the skeptic movement, where we're really coming up short and how we need to change.
Well, I would say just simply to support spaces that are forged by people of color, authentic, grassroots, politically progressive spaces, and to stop hating on progressive atheists of color.
Thank you for your voice. It was a very dense talk, so if I disappoint, I may not have picked them all up. I have sort of a two-part question. Is it the fact that the black church maybe teaches love and acceptance that's why the LGBT folks feel very comfortable there? And also, it's been my experience, I don't have any research to back this up, but that oftentimes it's women who maintain the religion and move the children into the religion and keep it flowing within the family. And so that's often what perpetuates the children to maintain that belief structure.
So, no to your first question, and I think, let's just say, provisionally, that it depends upon the church. If we're talking about maybe a non-denominational church like Agape, where it's more open and inclusive vis-a-vis LGBTQ and gender non-conforming folk. But harkening back to the earlier point in my speech, the issue is that there has always been a normalization of heterosexism and heteronormativity against queer and LGBTQ folk of African descent, even though you've had large numbers of, closeted LGBTQ and queer folk in the church. So there's a paradox there. When we cite these stats, provided by the Center for American Progress, I think what they indicate more than anything is the depth of segregation in African-American communities in particular, and in American society in general. The fact that there are very few safe spaces for African-Americans across sexual orientation and across gender.
Hi. I was wondering if you know, or if you're able to talk about, how is it that African-Americans became so attached to Christianity in the first place? Being brought over to the Americas involuntarily. And then secondarily, why is it that people of the LGBTQ movement are not only attaching themselves to Christianity, but you made mention briefly that they're actually moving more to the Bible Belt? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I would recommend that you check out some of Anthony Pym's work, and he's actually going to be speaking here tomorrow. We're talking about the trajectory of African Americans becoming indoctrinated into Judeo-Christian ideology, which, of course, is the reigning ideology of American society. So it's the template, you know, for American nationalist identity. And on the second question, LGBTQ folk moving in greater numbers to the Bible Belt, well, that's where a predominant part of the African American population is. So these are LGBTQ folk of African descent who are going back to their quote-unquote roots. They're going back to communities that have greater affordability when it comes to housing prices and rental prices. They have extended family there. There are, again, safer spaces, you know, vis-a-vis some of the more hyper-segregated urban, industrialized northern communities. So these are some of the compelling factors that are driving this out-migration back to the South, again, across gender and sexual orientation.
All right, thank you, everyone. That's enough time we have for questions. If we could give Sakibi one more round of applause, please.